From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And in a moment, a controversial decision in San Francisco to honor convicted Army leaker Chelsea Manning in the city's Gay Pride Parade.
But first, a very tender day here in Boston, the one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. A tribute is being held inside Boston's Heinz Convention Center, just a few blocks from the marathon finish line, where two bombs exploded on April 15, 2013, killing three, injuring more than 260, more than a dozen people lost limbs. Here now's Alex Ashlock is our longtime marathon reporter. He covered last year's race and aftermath, and he's at today's tribute. Alex, what can we expect today?
Well, Robin, it's going to be a very difficult day, I think, for most of the people inside the Heinz Convention Center, but especially for the families of the victims. There was 8-year-old Martin Richard, 29-year-old Crystal Campbell, and 23-year-old Lu Ling Zi. They will all be remembered at today's tribute.
Well, for people here in Boston, we've been seeing their images, but for those outside, just help us remember those three victims.
Here's the image that I think a lot of people may have seen. It's the picture of Martin Richard holding a hand-lettered sign that read, "No more hurting people." He did that in one of his classes, and that's one of the iconic images in the aftermath of the marathon bombings. Crystal Campbell attended the University of Massachusetts in Boston. She had been coming to the marathon since she was a little child, just like Martin Richard was doing on this day last year. And Lu Ling Zi was a Boston University graduate student. She was here from China. She loved classical music.
Lu Ling Zi's parents came in from China, and they want to be at the finish line of the marathon next week. They want to feel this power in this city. But today, people are remembering survivors of the attacks going to speak today, all the people who responded, the medical volunteers at the finish line, police officers, people there just to watch the race who ran to help. Everybody will be acknowledged.
Yes, and Vice President Joe Biden will be the final speaker. And I'm remembering the words of President Obama at the Marathon Memorial, which was held a few days after the bombings last April, when he said, "Scripture tells us to run with endurance the race before us."
Yeah. So today's remembrance of last year's marathon and this year's marathon, just 6 days away. How is what's happening today affecting runners?
Runners are pausing in their training and their excitement to mark this anniversary. I've been speaking to many of them. I spoke with a man named Tim King, who on Monday will be running the Boston Marathon for the 21st straight time. Here's what he said.
You know, it's time to close that past and start again. You know, Boston's a great place. It's full of energy. It's full of good people. And it's, you know, this is like this. It's, you know, we all came together and we did it together. And now it's time to move on to the next year.
Another veteran Boston Marathon runner is Michael Goslin. He had finished last year's race and was on his way home when the bombs went off. And here's how he's feeling about this day.
I think it's going to be a lot of mixed emotions. I think it's going to bring up a lot of the bad memories again, but I think we've made a lot of progress moving forward, and that's what I'm trying to focus on with my runs, is really looking at all the positive things that have happened in the last year and to move on.
So all these runners pausing, as you said, and you were telling me that Michael is one of the 100 runners who are on Team MR8. This is a team running in memory of Martin Richard, the little boy who was killed. Tell us more about that. And this, there's so many people running for people this coming race.
Yes, Robin, I think that's really the theme of this marathon. It's the 118th Boston Marathon. The theme this year is, I think, most of the runners, and there will be 36,000 of them this year. That's 9,000 more than last year. I think they're all running for other people, especially the people that were affected by what happened on this day 1 year ago.
Yeah, and just to tell our national listeners, on Sunday, they're not letting people sort of jump in the race this year. So on Sunday, there were a whole bunch of people who ran the race because they can't get in to next Monday's race. It's just amazing. So, Alex, you have run the marathon. What does this day mean to you?
I guess I would say this. I didn't know anyone who died. I didn't know anyone who was injured personally. But I know so many people, and I know you do too, Robin, who are running the race or who have run the race. I know the people who organized the race. I know people in the medical tent. I know a doctor who saved people's lives that afternoon a year ago, even if he couldn't save their limbs. So maybe that's the answer. It's had such a big impact on me because it's affected so many people I know. And it was an attack, really, on an event that I and so many thousands of other people love.
Well, and you could just have been speaking for, as you said, thousands of other people. By the way, and you mentioned the doctor. That's Dr. Ron Medson from Boston Medical Center, one of the people he helped save. Adrian Haslett Davis, the ballroom dancer who lost a leg. She's one of the people who will be speaking today?
That's correct.
Yeah. Alex Ashlock, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Well, now to San Francisco, where the naming of an honorary marshal for the annual Gay Pride Parade is causing a stir. The honor goes to Chelsea Manning, formerly known as Private Bradley Manning, who was convicted in a military court of espionage for turning over top-secret military documents to the anti-secrecy group WikiLeaks. 1 month later, Manning announced she wanted to live as a woman named Chelsea. And this is the second year in a row that Manning has been honored by San Francisco Pride, although last year that honor was rescinded after an outcry. Joining us on the line from San Francisco is Gary Virginia, volunteer president of the board of San Francisco Pride, which organizes the parade. Gary, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you've angered some members of the military with this decision. Why did you make it? Why decide to give Chelsea Manning this title of honorary Grand Marshal?
Well, first of all, she was legitimately elected a community Grand Marshal for last year's Pride Parade, and the board rescinded that honor, and the community and the membership of Pride was upset about it, and a new board was elected October 1st of last year. And we are fulfilling the wishes of the membership and a large part of the Bay Area community to say that we feel Chelsea Manning is owed an apology and that she should be awarded. So we're honoring her with an honorary Grand Marshal title this year.
Honoring her for what reason? What has she done that you want to honor?
Well, I think the community selected her last year because of her bravery to expose war crimes that our government was hiding. And they felt that she was wrongly prosecuted, treated poorly while she was imprisoned, and not really given a fair trial. So a lot's happened since then, as we've seen with Edward Snowden's choice of how he released information. And he credits Chelsea Manning with guiding him on how he's released his information. And I think the whole country and world has changed with the bravery of these whistleblowers exposing surveillance and war crimes and other things.
But there is still a big split when it comes to people's opinions about what Chelsea Manning did. I want to read to you some of it. Sean Sala, who is an LGBT military activist, has called for a national boycott of the Pride Parade, saying the fact that SF Pride would do this once again is just astounding. They will reap what they sow. They have spit in the face of the LGBT military community, all in the name of senseless ideology. How do you respond to criticism like that?
Well, I think that's a minority opinion. And when you look at organizations and people who are supportive of Chelsea Manning, like the Iraq Veterans Against the War, the Military Law Task Force of the National Lawyers Guild, the gay Bob Basker Post 315 of the American Legion here in San Francisco, the San Francisco Labor Council, Veterans for Peace, Queer Today, there's a whole host of people, including gay military people like Lieutenant Dan Choi, who was a huge advocate for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, U.S. Army Colonel retired Ann Wright, Ethan McCord, a former U.S. Army specialist, and Manning has won numerous awards. She has been nominated 3 times for the Nobel Peace Prize. She was awarded the Sam Adams Award for Integrity in Intelligence and also an award from the Global Exchange Human Rights Award. So I think that this is a minority opinion of people who had a different agenda out of San Diego, and it doesn't represent the majority opinion.
Well, here's another opinion. This is somebody on Facebook who is a currently serving in the Navy, a gay military member who says, what are San Francisco Pride Parade officials thinking? He, referring to Bradley Manning, who is now referred to as Chelsea Manning, lied, stole information. And no matter your beliefs, we swore an oath and Manning brought discredit to the U.S. Armed Forces.
I just think it's a difference of opinion about how people serve in the military. I think that there are laws that people are required when you're in the service to report crimes, and when you do it legitimately through the chain of command and nothing is done, I think people of conscience have a responsibility to speak out, and that's what Manning did.
What's the response been so far? Has there been a lot of blowback?
Not really. I mean, the Chelsea Manning Support Network has been in the Pride Parade for 3 years. This will be their 4th. And last year, in spite of all the controversy, they had the largest marching contingent that was non-corporate in the entire parade. It spanned numerous city blocks long, and there were also supporters in other contingents throughout the parade honoring Manning, even though the Pride Board rescinded their offer. So, quite honestly, there's not been much controversy here. There's a huge amount of support for Chelsea Manning, and we're expecting another large contingent in the parade with her being honored this year, along with a whole host of very qualified people, spanning a transgender 16-year-old from the Bay Area who was bullied to people in their 70s and 80s who were pioneers in the LGBT rights movement.
Well, but that's the question, I guess, is does it take away at all from those other honorees when you've got somebody who, at the very least, is divisive?
I think in the civil rights movement, the people who are activists and pioneers will always be controversial. And, you know, the Pride Parade and celebration, our goal is not to throw a big party. Our goal is to be a critical player in the civil rights movement for LGBT people, not only locally, but around the world. And our theme this year is Color Our World with Pride. And we'll be focusing heavily on what's happening in Russia, Uganda, Nigeria, Cameroon. There's really heinous state-sponsored laws coming down against gay people around the world. And I don't think that Chelsea Manning being honored would take anything away from that. And I think she's just part of the fabric of the movement.
Gary Virginia, volunteer president of the board of San Francisco Pride, which is organizing the 44th annual San Francisco Gay Pride celebration and parade in late June. Gary, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And let us know what you think of this decision in San Francisco to honor Chelsea Manning at the Gay Pride Parade. You can go to hereandnow.org, or you can send us a tweet at Here and Now, at Here and Now Robin, at Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
It's Here and Now, and it's tax day. Some post offices are staying open later today. Polls show nearly a quarter of us wait until the last minute to file after tackling a more and more complicated code. Now, most people think they pay too much in taxes, but our next guest says there's a group that doesn't pay enough. And the taxes add to the problem of income inequality. David K. Johnston is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and teacher at Syracuse University College of Law. His latest book is an anthology. It's called Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. He joins us in the studio. David, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And so, as I said, everyone thinks they pay too much. But you looked,
me too.
Yeah. You looked at a recent report from the IRS. Broadly, what did it find?
Well, it showed that, you're talking about the capital gains report,
mm-hmm.
that capital gains, the money you get from buying stocks or other assets at a low price and selling at a high price, have grown enormously in this country. But the way the pie is sliced has changed. So the bottom 90% of Americans, that's basically everybody who makes less than $100,000 a year, their slice of the pie is so much smaller that even though the pie is 40% bigger, the amount of pie they're getting has been cut in half.
Well, wait a second. You said capital gains, that's money from buying and selling stocks, for instance.
And
but
other
it's,
things, yeah.
It's also, well, yeah, it's money from selling homes that you've owned for after a year is the long-term
almost
capital gains.
Almost all of it's stocks, though.
Is that, see,
the
that's
overwhelming part.
Because some people think, well, wait a minute, capital gains are going to help me, too. Part of that pie is
sure.
me. And you're saying what? You're saying
I'm saying that the pie is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but the slice going to the roughly bottom 90% of Americans, the data show, has shrunk so much that your helping of pie, even though it's a much bigger pie, your helping of pie has been cut in half. And the people at the very top of the income group, the people who are making $10 million and more, that's about 18,000 households, their piece of the pie has grown from about 22% to 44%. When you consider how much bigger the pie is, they're doing fabulously well.
Well, and so what, you know, therefore, what does that mean? Because that's how many people in that bracket make their income. They buy and sell
right.
stocks. They buy and sell businesses.
Exactly.
So if it just so happens that they're making more by doing that, what?
Well, here's what's changed. You remember President Bush once talked about an ownership society. J.P. Morgan did a report, I think, a year ago saying we're becoming a rentership society. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans has fallen now back to the level of 1966. I'm eligible for Medicare. In 1966, I was in high school. So we've gone nowhere for the bottom 90%. If you go back 1 year to 2011, and you take the – there was a little higher income in 2011 than 1966 for the vast majority. And just count that as one inch. They got $59 more income after all those years. They got one inch. The plutocrat class, this is the small group at the top of, in this case, 16,000 because it's a different statistical measure, 16,000 households in a country of 316 million people. Compared to that one inch, their income is up 5 miles, just a bit under 5 miles, 1 inch to 5 miles. All the gains are going to the top, and it's not because everybody else got lazy or stupid. It's because we cut taxes at the top, we changed the rules, we put in place all these hidden subsidies I've been exposing for years that take from the many and redistribute upward to the few.
So the results of this pie, as you say, this capital gains pie, which is much bigger, the hugest proportion of it is going to this tiny fraction of Americans. Most of us, the way we're taxed is by wages. We have our taxes taken out of our paycheck. Whereas with capital gains earners, you say there's a discrepancy there as well.
Well, we had for a long time no checking up on this unless you were audited. Now, as a result of my work and that of a couple of other people, Congress finally put in some rules to reduce some of that. But if you're selling a business, no, it's still an honor system. And so as wages have been flat to falling for the vast majority of Americans and the income from capital gains has been going to the top, you're widening this inequality through government policy. Wages have been falling for a lot of reasons, you know, encouraging the movement of jobs offshore, decimating unions, changes in the law, and getting rid of welfare as we know it in 1995, which flooded the market with low-skill workers and held down those wages.
Well, you say there's another sort of adding of insult to injury, that a lot of people who are wage earners, as they run into economic trouble in the past few years, they start selling whatever assets they had, and that is getting gobbled up by the people who can afford to buy it, who tend to be in that.
In 2009, the stock market was at 7,600 on the Dow. It's now at over 16,000. It's been unbelievable growth of the stock market under President Obama. Those people who had plenty of assets and weren't constrained by the downturn were able to use their dividends and their cash and other to buy up stocks cheap, and that's why they have done fabulously well. Whereas people who lost their jobs, many of them had to cash in their 401ks, and guess what? Congress imposes a 10% penalty tax if you're under 59 and a half. It doesn't matter that you're out of work. Doesn't matter that your spouse is out of work. You have this penalty tax, and it's one
of— Well, they're trying to get people to save.
Well, yes, yeah. But it's one of many— There's no exception, though. It's one of many examples that I've shown over the years of how the law is biased in favor of people at the very top.
Because, as you say, these people with the wherewithal turn around and buy up whatever the assets were of those bottom 90%.
Well, and also they have access to members of Congress that you and I don't have. If you're just an ordinary citizen and try to get 5 minutes with your congressman or senator, lots of luck. If you are a representative of some wealthy interest, you won't have much trouble.
Well, then this is your overarching point, is that it's policy, it's government policy that makes for this inequity, and that the people who make policy, you're pretty much saying, are in the pocket of that sliver of Americans who are benefiting from the tax code.
And I'm actually sympathetic to them. I mean, if I were to be in Congress, I'm not going to be in Congress, but if I were, I would face the same pressures they face. It's the system that is doing this to them, and it's how the reforms we intended after Watergate and some state scandals have been turned on their head. You know, a shield has been turned into a sword against us.
Well, but let's hear the arguments on the other side. First of all,
rising tide lifts all boats.
Well, a ballooning capital gains pie lifts all boats. I mean, that this will trickle down to jobs.
If that were true and that's what the data showed, I'd be all for it. What the data show isn't trickle down, but Niagara up. More and more capital is being invested in unproductive ways. It's being used in this high-speed trading and to froth the market, which I've been writing about for years, and there's now an excellent book out by Michael Lewis explaining as an insider how this stuff works and how we had a bunch of dishonest markets. American corporations that are multinational have figured out how to turn the corporate income tax into a profit center. They actually make money off the corporate income tax. But if you're a domestic business, you can't do that. You have to pay your taxes.
Well, so what would you suggest? The idea that you propose of changing the tax code would seem impossible.
Well, I've argued for a long time that we have a tax system that is very well defined for the 20th century when we were an industrial economy. We need to start with a white paper and a whole new approach to taxes. We may even want to get rid of the corporate income tax. We need to study that. We need to tax where the economy is now, which is services, cyberspace, molecules, materials and biotechnology, and understand where the economy is going and shift the way we tax. And that requires a lot of intellectual work that isn't being done.
Okay. We'll leave it at that. Pick it up at another time. David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, also author of the new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. We'll link you to some of his writing. You can look at the capital gains pie at hereandnow.org. David, thanks as always.
Thank you.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as you've no doubt heard in the morning headlines, today the Ukrainian government began what it's calling an anti-terrorist operation to push pro-Russia demonstrators in the eastern part of the country out of the government buildings they've been occupying. The Russian-leaning separatists ignored an earlier call from Ukraine's president to disarm or face full-scale force. There have been conflicting reports all day of skirmishes. The airport in the city of Kramatorsk was briefly under control of the insurgents, but it's now reportedly back under Ukrainian control. We've seen pictures of Ukrainian tanks moving east. NPR's international correspondent Ari Shapiro is in Ukraine. Ari, what are you seeing and hearing?
First, to set the scene for you, we're talking about a very large region in eastern Ukraine known as the Donetsk sector. But the action this morning began in a city called Slavyansk, where, as you say, Ukrainian troops showed up. Unarmed protesters confronted those tanks and said, "What are you going to do, shoot us? Who are you going to shoot?" They started swearing and yelling at the tank drivers. This was according to video posted on YouTube. More recently, there seems to be activity in the town of Kramatorsk, which is some distance from Slavyansk. These are just two cities out of close to a dozen where there have been flare-ups throughout the region. So we're talking about a really wide geographic area and a military effort that can be difficult to monitor at times.
Yeah. Well, there are accusations also flying back and forth. Ukraine and the West accusing Russia of ginning up these protests. Russia accusing the Ukrainian government of inflaming situations. What is the sense of whether or not this had to happen? What's the Ukrainian government's goal here?
Well, I think the role of the Russians has become more apparent in the last week plus. I came here when the demonstrations first started unfolding, and they really did kind of feel authentically local. More recently, we see people identifying themselves as officers in the Russian military. Certainly, many locals here do identify with that sentiment that they want to be closer to Russia. But the Russian military has been just over the border for many, many days now, and the West accuses Russia of ginning up this entire thing as a pretext to invade and take over eastern Ukraine the way they annexed Crimea. The difference is here in eastern Ukraine, there is, I think, a much more diverse sentiment. Many, many more people who do not want to be part of Russia, in addition to those who sympathize with the view from Moscow. So you're seeing more tension and certainly, you know, more violence than we had seen in the takeover of Crimea.
Well, and you're seeing tanks, you know, Ukrainian tanks in the region. I mean, what is the is your sense of how much of a tinderbox this is becoming?
People are heavily armed on both sides, and everybody says they don't want to be the first person to fire a shot. But the government says it can't just allow these cities to fall where people are raising the flag either of Russia or of what they call the Independent Republic of Donetsk. And so in an effort to take back these cities, we saw on Sunday as people died that people are willing to exchange fire, and this could become very explosive in a very short time.
Well, and you visited a town that's been controlled by separatists, these pro-Russian separatists. What did you see there?
We were taken inside the police headquarters that had been taken over. People were fortifying the barricades with more sandbags and tires. They were building Molotov cocktails. One of the odd details is that they took us into a room where police officers were still on the job, manning computers and answering phones, because the protesters told us they still wanted people dialing the Ukrainian equivalent of 911 to get somebody on the other end. They were very concerned with preserving order, even as they declared the headquarters to be the People's Republic of Donetsk. A lot of uniformed officers were coming and going, either sympathetic to the protesters, which we've seen among many police officers in this region, or just not wanting to kick up a fuss.
NPR's international correspondent Ari Shapiro in Ukraine. Ari, thank you.
Good to talk to you.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
It's here and now, and as we heard earlier this hour, the city of Boston is paying tribute today to victims of the marathon bombings that happened a year ago. The Boston Pops Orchestra opened today's tribute ceremony with a performance of A Hymn to New England. Well, at this point on this day last year, the race was still underway. But when the bombs went off, three people were killed, more than 260 injured, many requiring amputations. By most accounts, first responders handled last year's tragedy at the marathon finish line as well as could be expected. Decades of disaster drills paid off, with thousands of people from various agencies joining forces to try and save as many lives and limbs as possible. So how are officials preparing for next Monday's race? From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WBUR's Deborah Becker reports.
For several months now, emergency responders, law enforcement officials, and others have been gearing up for the possibility of another marathon attack. Master Sergeant Kenneth Huddleston with the Federal Department of Homeland Security's Mobile Training Unit recently held an explosives ID class for police at the marathon starting line.
The start of the marathon here in Hopkinton, it's a very attractive place, if you will, to bad guys. So what better place to start to increase the awareness and increase the security than right here?
This is one of dozens of preparedness sessions that focus on topics such as supporting a bomb squad and responding to terrorism or suicide bombings. Instructor Kurt Tilley shows a video of how to handle a motorist who's behaving suspiciously.
Driver, what's your name? Benjamin. And what's your last name?
How many of you have done traffic stops like this?
Taurus.
What do you know right away?
Yes. Yes.
Something's wrong.
Okay.
Tilly takes the class out to the parking lot to search a car. He identifies clues that reveal a fake bomb under the hood.
You know, wired in. Do you have your power, your initiator, your switch, your explosive?
Police will conduct searches like this at security checkpoints along the marathon route. It's one of dozens of extra precautions in place this year. Centralized medical emergency centers are also part of preparedness efforts.
This is our command center, so this is the area where we send our incident management team.
Maureen McMahon is Director of Emergency Management at Boston Medical Center. She's taken me to a large room in a nondescript building near the hospital filled with desks, computers, televisions, and phones. Four people will staff this center Marathon Monday.
We'll have people coming in and out. We might be getting reports from the field. We'll be requesting information. So this is going to be a monitoring condition. It's not going to be an activation, a full activation.
Full activation was last year, when hospitals had just minutes to prepare for scores of severely injured people. Not one patient taken to a Boston hospital died. But hospitals want to prevent another case of mistaken identity. That's what happened with Karen Rand. She was carrying her friend Crystal Campbell's ID when she was transported from the finish line to Mass General for amputation surgery. Campbell died at the finish line. But Campbell's family was told that she was in surgery, not Rand.
While I understand how it happened, I had Crystal's identification and her phone on me, I still think that even as crazy as it was, there has to be a way to identify people, whether it's what they look like, what size they are, you know, the age, anything, some kind of characteristics that when family are calling and saying, this is what the person I'm looking for looks like, you have some other way to identify a little bit easier.
Paul Bittinger, Medical Director for Emergency Preparedness at MGH, says the hospital has improved its systems.
And we've worked very hard with our staff to make sure that everyone is trained on our state-of-the-art procedures for how to identify what is proper and what is not proper identification for the victims.
But Bittinger and other hospital workers say the core issue they're working on is emotional preparedness, not just for the anniversary of the bombings, but also for next week's race. The Schwartz Center for Compassionate Healthcare, a national nonprofit, has been holding drop-in meetings for medical caregivers to discuss with their peers their feelings about responding to the marathon. At one recent session, many admitted that they are still processing the trauma. Vicki Noble, an emergency room physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, helped facilitate.
And I think my feeling that day, and continues to be my feeling, which I think gives me some strength, was one of immense pride. Sorry. I thought I was doing better, too. I just felt I was watching the pre-hospital teams and watching the police, watching the firefighters, watching the volunteers, and I was just so proud.
Organizers of these sessions issued a report describing an array of caregiver emotions, fear, guilt, anxiety about the marathon and the anniversary, and resentment that a signature Boston event has been forever marred by violence. For Here and Now, I'm Deborah Becker in Boston.
And we're following other news today. Prosecutors in Kansas have filed murder charges against Frazier Glenn Cross, the white supremacist who authorities say killed three people at two Jewish centers outside Kansas City. Cross has been charged with capital murder in the deaths of a 14-year-old, Reed Underwood, and his grandfather, William Lewis Corporan, outside the Jewish Community Center of Greater Kansas City. He's also charged with murdering Terry Lamano, who is visiting her mother at a nearby retirement complex. Federal prosecutors are pursuing their own hate crime case against Cross. And in Australia, a robotic submarine looking for the lost Malaysian Airlines jet has begun its second dive. The U.S. Navy and search coordinators say a built-in safety feature stopped the mission yesterday after the sub entered an area of the Indian Ocean deeper than the vehicle's maximum depth. The sub, known as Bluefin 21, did collect some data in its maiden voyage, but failed to turn up any signs of the missing plane.
And a quick program note, as parents and high school students decide where they are going to go to college, we're going to talk with a college counselor on Thursday on the show. We want to get your questions answered. Any questions you have about the college admissions process, what kind of classes you or your kid should be taking in high school, how much SAT studying you should do, and what will help you stand out amid today's intense competition for spots at colleges and universities. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/hereandnowradio. You can send us a tweet at Here and Now, or you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. And again, we'll get answers to as many questions as we can. We'll be speaking with a college counselor on the show on Thursday. This is Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and today is the first day of Passover. Easter is this coming Sunday, which means it is spring, and for some people that means it is lamb season. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst joins us in the studio now to talk all about lamb. Kathy, good to see you as always.
Hi, Jeremy.
And lamb and spring do seem to go together very well.
I would say along with chives and peas and asparagus, maybe artichokes, they are the symbol of spring. In the world of meat, there is nothing that symbolizes spring more than lamb.
And yet, all year round, lamb is not as popular as chicken, pork, and beef in the U.S.
This is true. Lamb sales are way beneath those three other meats. I think that a lot of people grew up with mutton, which is old lamb, which is super strong and unappealing and unattractive.
And they remember that.
They remember it and they never want to go back to it. But lamb is becoming much more popular thanks to the trend of Middle Eastern cooking, all the focus on Middle Eastern flavors. Lamb is a very favored meat in the Mediterranean, throughout the Middle East, and people are starting to experiment with it more. Just so you know what a fanatic I am, every year, there's a farmer down the street from where we live in southern Maine, and I buy a lamb from her, and I never know when it's coming, and there'll be a knock on the door. This will upset some people. Close your ears, vegetarians. But she knocks on the door, and she has the entire animal slung over her shoulder. It's been cleaned.
That upsets me, and I'm not a vegetarian.
Well, you know, if you're going to eat it, you need to. So we buy an entire animal, and with a friend who is a butcher, we cut it into pieces, and we freeze it, and we eat it year-round. The real point of this story is that it's very nice to know where your meat was raised and how it was raised. Yeah. This is a lamb that had a really beautiful life and ate very well, and therefore we eat very well all year.
This is starting to sound like an episode of Portlandia.
Oh, no.
Okay. What about when you go into the store? Let's pretend like you don't have a lady that comes over to your house.
Let's pretend.
And knocks on the door. What are you supposed to do?
Wait, are you telling me you don't have that lady?
I don't have that at all. No.
It's called a farmer.
So let's say you go to the market and you want to get some lamb. What are you looking for? looking for? What kind
okay.
of cuts?
Well, there are so many different cuts. The most popular cuts, and particularly around spring for Easter, and also some Jews do at Passover eat lamb, though there's a controversy around that. Lamb is mentioned in the Bible, and there are a lot of Jews who won't eat lamb at Passover if it's roasted. But if you braise it, if there's liquid added, then it's acceptable. There's a whole long explanation of that. But let's talk about that. Lamb shanks, also called the shin, is a really fairly inexpensive cut of meat. Delicious, delicious cut of meat on the bone. Braise it, which means it's cooked in a little bit of liquid, very, very slowly, till it just falls off the bone. And flavors like cinnamon and nutmeg and garlic and chili pepper, and you could add apricots or prunes and nuts, and it becomes a very Moroccan style or Middle Eastern dish.
What about lamb chops?
That's what
I always see.
Yeah, that's what we grew up on. It's the most expensive cut, absolutely delicious. There's the shoulder chop, which has some fat and gristle and is not the most expensive. There's the rib chop, which comes from the rack and includes the rib and the loin. And then there are the loin chops. Those are the really meaty, tender, buttery ones that come at the highest price. And those are fabulous sautéed or grilled or broiled. I mean, it's getting warm. A grilled lamb chop outdoors with a brushing of olive oil, some fresh rosemary, cracked pepper, nothing better.
What about when you have to cook it? What are you supposed to do?
It really depends what cut. The leg of lamb, which is my personal favorite, there are two types. There's the bone-in or there's a butterflied leg of lamb where they remove the bone and the two flaps of meat resemble a butterfly. What I love to do with a leg of lamb that's been butterflied is to marinate it with fresh mint and garlic and red wine. Let it sit overnight. Then take it out of the marinade and throw it on the hot grill outdoors, summertime, springtime. Just, it's so delicious. It's all this very tender, flavorful meat. For a whole leg of lamb with the bone in for Easter, you could rub it in garlic and good Greek yogurt, some paprika, a little bit of chili pepper.
Making kind of a little tzatziki sauce.
Exactly.
There.
What happens is that the yogurt creates a glaze. When you heat the leg of lamb, you want to start it at a very high temperature, 450, and then put it down to 325, and you let it cook. There are a few things to keep in mind when you're cooking lamb. For very rare meat, you want to go for 125 degrees. Now, these are temperatures that you use an instant thermometer. You put it into the thickest part of the meat. And when the temperature reaches, not the numbers I'm talking about, but 5 degrees below them, because meat will continue to cook once it's outside of the oven. So it's really important. So if you want your lamb very rare or very pink, you want to shoot for 125 as the final temperature. So you want to take it out at 120. For medium rare, which is where I like it, 130 to 135. So that's a very good tip to know.
You're a medium rare person, not rare for lamb?
I don't like rare.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's okay. We'll allow you to come back anyway.
Is this a personality flaw?
Next
Do we
time?
Need to talk
no,
about
No, that's
this?
Fine. But, okay. You know, some people like it a little more rare. That's all I'm saying.
Another question a lot of people ask me, well, how much meat per person? When you're working with a bone-in leg of lamb, about 3/4 to a pound of meat per person. A rack of lamb, depending on the size, about 1/2 to 1/4 of a rack per person. And with the boneless butterfly of lamb, about 3/4 of a pound per person. Can I tell you something with leftovers?
Yes.
Like day after Easter, day after Passover, you take your leftover lamb and you make a hash, like corned beef hash, but with lamb, so with potatoes and maybe some parsnips and the lamb, and you cook it and you press it down and you make like a pancake and then poach an egg with some hot sauce and throw it on that lamb hash.
Breakfast.
You'll be very, very happy with that.
You know, hearing you describe all of these different ways of cooking lamb, I can't help think of the Greeks. They all sound like such Greek-style recipes in a way, and the Greeks love lamb.
Absolutely. They adore it. In fact, Greek Easter, which I believe falls on the same day as regular Easter.
This year, I think it does.
That what the Greeks do is they have whole baby lambs and they will roast the entire lamb on a rotisserie spit. I was once invited to a Greek Easter and the guy had it set up in his garage in New England. One of the most memorable meals of my life. But this entire lamb in this guy's garage on a rotisserie spit just being basted in garlic and olive oil with the crispy skin. I don't know why Americans don't embrace this meat more. It is so full of flavor. It's earthy. Maybe we like a more neutral flavored meat, but lamb is something worth trying. Speaking of which,
yes,
I made you something.
Oh, good. Yes, finally, so my favorite part.
These are lamb meatballs. I took coriander seeds, fennel seeds, and cumin seeds and heated them and then crushed them. So we have this great spice mixture. And then this is ground lamb and fresh mint. And that is a Greek yogurt. Speaking of
okay,
Greek,
I'm gonna, so I should dip it in the
absolutely.
Greek yogurt here.
Greek yogurt with fresh mint and scallions and a little bit of hot pepper sauce. Really, really easy. Great light dinner with pita bread and some salad. Very Middle Eastern there.
The Greek yogurt really makes it.
Isn't it? It's so creamy. The thing about lamb, too, is that it's not that fatty. A lot of the ground lamb that you find in stores is really not very fatty at all, but just enough to give it some flavor. And with these delicious spices, there's yogurt in that meatball as well. And then you roll them in panko breadcrumbs, and you cook them in olive oil, and you can do it all ahead of time and throw it into the oven. So another quick, very different holiday idea.
Do you think Americans are ever going to embrace lamb the way that they do beef or chicken?
I would say time will tell. Probably not the way they do chicken and beef, but I think that lamb is an extremely healthy meat. If you learn how to cook it properly, you will fall in love with it.
Kathy, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
That's Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who is, by the way, a James Beard Award nominee for her work on this program. She's also the author of Notes from a Maine Kitchen, seasonally inspired recipes. And you can find Kathy's tips on cooking lamb and some recipes, including her lamb hash and those delicious lamb meatballs, at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.